Welcome to Holden Village Media Ministry. Today's date is June 11th, 1998. This is a forum entitled Language as Power, Ethical Implications of the Global Spread of English. The call number on this tape is FO98-3. Let's listen in.
Especially in just thinking about what I want to do as my career, and thinking, you know, where do I want to teach? So I want to present some of the ideas I've thought about over the years to you, and I want it to be a discussion too. I want to hear your perspectives and your stories, and I think it's a very volatile issue, but very worth discussing. And I hope I can give you some new perspectives that maybe you haven't thought about. Is that Jerry? Jerry? Oh, I guess that's not Jerry. Sorry, I thought you were Jerry. No.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You've started, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes. Are you taking this?
Yep.
Okay, I wasn't sure.
Okay. Jerry's over.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Tape journal, you can tape ministry, you can begin. Okay, I forgot that part. So the title of this discussion is Language as Power, specifically English language. This is a statistic from 1987, and I want to read some of this for you just to sort of set the tone. This says that total number of English speakers numbers between 700 million and 1 billion. That's a really big discrepancy there. It's very difficult to count exactly how many speakers of English there are because it's rapidly rising all the time because there's so many people learning. There's native speakers, there's second language, and there's people who just learn it. Maybe they hardly even use it, but they still know enough English to get by. This is from Cambridge Encyclopedia of Language. English is used as an official or semi-official language in over 60 countries and has a prominent place in a further 20. It is either dominant or well-established in all six continents. It is the main language of books, newspapers, airports, and air traffic control, international business and academic conferences, science, technology, medicine, diplomacy, sports, international competitions, pop music, and advertising. Over two-thirds of the world's scientists write in English. Three-quarters of the world's mail is written in English. Of all the information in the world's electronic retrieval systems, 80% is stored in English. English radio programs are received by over 150 million people in 120 countries. Over 50 million children study English as an additional language at primary level. Over 80 million study it at secondary level. That does not include China, by the way. In any one year, the British Council helps 250,000 foreign students to learn English in various parts of the world. In the USA alone, 337,000 foreign students were registered in 1983. So we have some pretty amazing numbers here to think about. I want to ask you all a question. When you think of the influence of English in the world, what do you think about? What are some of your experiences or opinions about this? Yes?
Colonialism is what I think of.
I'm going to write down some of these words. Okay, colonialism.
To kind of go along with getting to be power.
Other things you think about?
Ease of communication for those of us who speak English.
Okay, good one. Ease of, communication. For English speakers. That definitely goes along with the first two. We are at a definite advantage as native speakers of English. And that's a very important consideration in this whole discussion. Other things you think about?
What about slang?
Slang, that's
idioms.
Yeah.
The two go together.
So English is making its way into other languages, even
right
for people who don't speak English.
Yeah, a lot of idioms in English actually become words in other languages. or even just very common words. I know when I was learning German, I was coming across all sorts of scientific technological words that were English words, and I thought, wow, that's really strange. Das Computer. I'm like, there's got to be a different word for that. But also, as an ESL teacher, my students have the worst time with idioms. And if you really want to truly understand the English language, you need to understand this, a certain amount of slang and idioms. And
this is very impressive when you try to speak a foreign language or speak to foreign language speaking people. Well, I'm thinking in terms of my son-in-law who is French, and I realize how much of my speaking deals with idioms that he doesn't has. He knows a great many of them because he's been speaking English for some time, but even so, there are some that are beyond the pale. Well, there's one, for example, beyond the pale. What could that mean to him?
Kick the bucket.
Kick the bucket, raining cats and dogs. And the French, by the same token, have some rather strange idioms. And
So students learning English have a very, very difficult time. The other thing about English is it does not have the most regular rules in the world. It has influences from so many different languages all over the world that spelling is really awful, the grammar is very confusing. Every grammar rule you teach, there's about 10 exceptions. So it's very difficult for students to learn. This is a good start, colonialism, power. And I think this shows you that there's a power imbalance, that people who speak English have an advantage in the world. And a lot of Americans who go to travel never really think about learning another language. A lot of them do, but a lot of people think, oh, I don't need to learn another language. Everyone speaks English. I can just go and everyone will accommodate me. That is very closely related with the power issue. Okay, any other things?
Investment.
Oh, very good.
The whole internet system would go along with that.
Yeah. The world of business, internet, computer language is mostly undertaken in English. So as the internet develops and becomes more popular around the world, this is a conduit for English to become more and more.
The other thing that's interesting is living up in Canada now, where their English, I don't know what they call it, proper English or whatever, but in the computers, because they spell certain words different than they do in the U.S. Mm-hmm. A lot of the computers are coming from the U.S. And so, you know, like they'll do spell check. And it'll be obviously wrong in Canada, but it'll be right in the U.S. But
right.
You know, so that's kind of interesting.
The anglicization of words.
Exactly.
Oh,
that if we have American spell checks all over the world, it's going to be American English they're going to have to learn. They'll get very confused. Okay, I want to think about all these issues, and I want to talk about a case study of a woman from the Sudan, and tell you some of the things she had to say about her experience learning English. And I think you'll see the thing that I saw a video of this interview. It's an ESL teacher who did an interview with her. It was a class project he was doing. And he interviewed students from all over the world and asked them, what is your opinion about learning English? And she had some very strong words. She talks about colonialism. She talks about power. And I was very impressed with her use of slang and idioms. She had a masterful use of English. And I think you'll see that in some of her quotations.
Yeah, see, I don't know if this is the proper time. It may be well later, but we may want to consider that at one time in the world, French was the language, the international language,
right.
And it's English that is replacing it. So did the French have the same...
I think it'll be worth asking, what is the role of English in the future? Certainly. Is it going to go the same way as French and another language will become the dominant language? We'll get back to that. That's a very good point. Okay. The first point I want to talk about is the relationship between language and culture. Language and culture. A lot of people think that, oh, you can just learn another language and you're learning just words and you can just plug in English words to other words and You don't have to learn a different culture, but I would disagree. I want you to look at this first quotation from this woman from the Sudan. And she's talking about, as a girl, learning English in a missionary school, which is where she learned English. And this is what she says. I think when you learn a different language, you change your perception and view of the world. As I went to school and I was forced to learn English, I was forced to accept a foreign ideology, a foreign system of thinking, a foreign way of seeing the world. In other words, my way of seeing the world was slowly being eradicated. Those are some powerful words. Any comments on her? Any agrees or disagrees or?
I'm really interested in knowing what, in a specific, I deal better with specifics than vague generalities. What did she see at one point that was changed because she had to think or speak in English?
Was this woman educated only in English when she went to the school?
Yes. Okay. It's a missionary school run only in English. Her parents sent her to this school because they knew it was the best school and they wanted her to have all the educational opportunities. She talked a lot about one difference between English and her language is her language is not written down. And so it's very difficult to learn this in school, learning to read and write. And I think just the difference between having your language be a written language and having not a written language is a huge cultural difference. I think that's one example. She felt like she had to learn how to read and write in English in order to be a viable citizen in her country.
Does that prevent her from expressing ideas from her culture, though?
Definitely not. But
it almost sounds like this, that she can't think about her culture anymore now that she knows English.
I want to think about some other examples. There's a lot of words that don't translate. And when words don't translate, ideas also don't translate. One really powerful example is in the Navajo language. I saw a speaker of Navajo language in graduate school, and he was telling us how in Navajo there is no word for "I'm sorry." There's no word. And he was looking at English and saying, in English it's too easy. You just say, "I'm sorry." And a lot of people think, okay, I say I'm sorry and that's it. In Navajo, there's no words. You have to act. You have to show that you are sorry. And there's one example of a real cultural difference. It's not something you can learn just by going to class. It's a whole new cultural idea. Another idea that Jane told me the other day was in Wales. In the Welsh language, there's a word that, what's the word again?
Hiraeth, H-I-R-A-E-T-H, Hiraeth. Hiraeth.
And the meaning of the word is love of your and home country.
Right, and longing for.
Longing.
And love for
Wales.
How
you feel when you're away from it.
Right.
How you feel when you're away from
for Wales.
Wales specifically.
For Wales specifically.
And it's a word in that language that talks about that. When they had to learn English in Wales, there's not a word for that anymore. And so, in a sense, is that feeling being taken away also? I saw a hand. Yes. Yes.
No. Well, I don't know how it comes into how you're heading, but when you learn another language and then have to converse in it, it becomes very clear to you what she's talking about. I haven't had the experience, but Fred Rejan, or however you pronounce his name, was up here once, and then we had him to our congregation for a forum. He's East Indian. But is a Lutheran and in the ELCA Higgins Road complex, you know, converses in English, does everything in English.
Mm-hmm.
But he said when he prays at night, he prays in his native, I forget what it is, it's an Indian dialect. I don't remember which one, but he, because that's part of who he is. And so if you had to learn a different language, your original language is imprinted in you in a way that is part of you.
Right. And I think that's really important. If you go to school And you're not allowed to express yourself in the language you're most comfortable with, the language you would pray in. I think you're a little uncomfortable in a school setting.
And as a teacher, English is a second language. It must be something that you hear of students who come, who, if they're young, are in a home where English is not the primary language, because somehow the discourse in the household has to be in what they, who they are.
And as a result, they're not getting a lot of reinforcement in English, and so that makes the learning of English even more difficult.
I think that what we were talking about just now, about the difference between your language that you learn as a baby and that is kind of like your home language versus the language that you need to use in discourse with other people beyond your home, I think that's a real important distinction to think about. I think that it happens even in people who know English as their first language too, that they use their language at home differently than they do at the office place. So that there's a difference, even if it's monolingual or if there's more than one language being used at home and all. I disagree, though, about that you can't express ideas from one language to another, because we were just doing it.
But you can express
ideas.
You
said there's this one word. It just happens to be that it's one word in Welsh, but we need to use a few more words in English, but we can still express the idea. I mean, we got a sense of what that meaning was. It's like, I'm familiar with Spanish and also with Greek and Hebrew, and translating those words into English, sometimes we try to use only one word. Like, in the beginning, the word became flesh, logos. And so we say, logos is word. Well, it's a little bit more than that.
Right.
And we're kind of bound to word-for-word translation.
Right.
And that is limiting.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's what people who are trying to translate from their home language into English or deal with that is, we have a concept that you have to translate word-for-word.
Yeah.
It's not quite that way.
When I'm trying to translate a letter, for example, or something from French to English, I can't do it verbatim. My husband tries to get me to, what's this word, and then put it all together, and it doesn't work that way.
Right.
And you have to translate concepts and ideas, and I can get the gist of it, but I certainly couldn't translate it verbatim.
And imagine how much more difficult it would be to translate something if the cultures are radically different, as is the case with, she's learning British English and the Sudan, I think. Because the farther apart the cultures get, the more difficult it is to translate even ideas. And when she says this, I really have no idea what she's talking about. Even the specifics, I don't know enough about the culture of the Sudan to know how she felt about that. Jennifer?
Aren't we looking at the glass half empty here? Because, we could look at it another way and say, this woman has an incredibly rich opportunity to learn something completely different. And I look at that as someone who is completely conversant and fluent in two different languages and two different cultures has an enormous advantage. So I see her as being very, very fortunate in what she's being able to speak. And I think that's because of my background and my education. Yes, English is the language of commerce and of diplomacy and things like that. But at the same time, I think Americans are at such a disadvantage because they usually only speak one language. So how can we compete with these other people who do speak fluent English as well as we do, and 2, 3, 4 other languages, which is common in Switzerland and a lot of other places? So I can understand how maybe she would like to do more in her own language, but school is only 6 hours a day. You've got, the rest of your life to converse with your friends and your classmates between classes and your family. So I mean, I can understand what she means, because I've lived in other cultures as well where I don't speak the language very well, and you do revert back to your own language very, very quickly because that's what's comfortable. It takes a lot of energy to be in a different culture and learn something new.
Yes,
but
yes.
The effort is definitely worth it, and she'll be so much ahead of even Americans if she speaks English well, because she'll know something as, you know, she'll know her Sudan culture as well. So I don't see it as, it's hard for me to feel sorry for this woman when I envy her.
Yeah, exactly. One thing she did say is that she knows she's very lucky, and she knows that she's had this advantage, but nobody else in her family had this advantage. And as a result, her family members, she's in the United States studying at a university, I can't remember which university she was studying at, MIT, I think. And she was going to, she had the chance to be very influential in her country or here. She could get a very good job. But she said, it's not equal who can learn English in her country and who doesn't have access to it. And because a lot of people don't have access to it, they don't have access to exactly what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. So she's thinking about the whole big
picture. I mean, definitely in countries like this that are very poor, in a lot of third world countries, I mean, that does create an elite very quickly, which is good and bad. I mean, you do need educated people, but again, I don't know the process by which those people are selected. And that's probably done very young by who is allowed to learn English at age 6 or what.
Exactly. Her parents set her up for it.
Yeah.
And she has the ability now to share what she has learned through her knowledge of English to share with this, her compatriots.
I think it's even in our urban centers, though, where it's not so much the elite or, like, in, say, in India would be caste system or something. In our country, it's by your skin color. How many people who graduate from high school are pushed into alternative schools, pushed out of the educational system, and they don't learn how to speak correctly or write English because they can't relate to any of the, they can't relate to see Dick and Jane run and play in the white picket fence yard.
Yeah. Mark, you had a...
Oh, I think I'm just sort of following other footsteps when I say that language is relational and that, you know, when she talks about the way of seeing the world as being eradicated, coming in of English, it's a matter of just an entire worldview, an entire way of relating with a group of people. You know, so I guess you know, you're trying to get at language and culture. I think the two in that sense are kind of synonymous. The way she phrases it, it sounds like English is slowly becoming the dominant language in the Sudan. And, you know, bit by bit, the old stories, the ways of speaking, the familiar ways of knowing each other are turning into something else.
Yeah.
You know, no longer do we sit around a fire and tell stories, but we write them down and we go to a library and we look at, you know, what it was that our culture is supposed to mean to us. So, there's that entire relational aspect that goes on with language issues that it feels to me, at least, she's trying to get at in this quote.
She said another part of her review, she worries that her language will be dead in another 50 years. She worries about that. And because there's not very many speakers, her language group is pretty small. And that's something I can't even imagine, you know, English.
We have the same problem over in the Okanagan, I mean, with the Colville tribes.
Yeah.
This is a Salish, I think, is the language, that the elders are trying to teach a certain number of the young so that the language doesn't die out. And
the
kids just aren't interested for the most part.
And why? Because what will that get them? It's not going to get them jobs. It's not going to get them status in society. English can do that.
Yeah, but by the same token, an educated person has knowledge, and this is another area of knowledge, to know another language.
Exactly.
And that in itself is empowering.
Yes, and it should be. I think one problem, perhaps, is that our society doesn't view that as empowering. It views, are you economically viable? English is economically viable. Salish, unfortunately, is not. And I think that economic viability should not be the only standard for the survival of a language. And I think that's something that is definitely worth thinking about. Because in a lot of places, the spread of English has meant the death of many other languages.
So,
So it's really, I mean, it's really two different issues.
Fair enough. Well, it's more than two different issues.
I mean, it's, yeah, yeah, there's many, but what we're talking about, from what I'm hearing, is that there's the idea of, you know, someone losing their language and therefore losing their culture, which I think is a totally different issue than English being the only economically viable language and therefore kind of taking over. So it's kind of, you know, it's...
Those are very different issues. Kind of,
so...
And one doesn't necessarily rule out the other.
Yeah.
But if you care enough about your own language and your own culture, seems to me you ought to be doing something about sustaining
right.
it.
Right.
Perpetuating it, whatever.
Right. Yeah. I have a question. As an English as a second language teacher, I agree. Whenever you travel abroad, I always felt completely inferior. Not because I only spoke English and I had to find people who spoke, and so many people speak English, but I felt like I had to search out and I was just in grade. And then I think in schools, in American schools, teaching English is sort of this, you know, thing that everybody does, and then teaching foreign languages, oh yeah, you can take as many years as you want and learn. Nothing to speak of. I mean, I can't go and speak to anyone because it's second languages here aren't viewed as anything, and I think
right. Yeah.
You think teaching English as a second language, they're forced to learn it at a much faster rate. Exactly, and they have a lot of motivation to learn it. and it's around them everywhere. I think you have an excellent point. And I think part of a solution to the problem that English presents is to make foreign language teaching much more common in the United States. Make it more mandatory in schools for them to learn other languages and to understand how difficult that really is. Because it's incredibly difficult.
Don't we also, I think we have it kind of wrong anyways, in the sense that most languages that are taught in schools in America are taught usually, it doesn't happen until junior high or high school.
Right.
And don't we, I think somewhere I've heard that really we have a propensity, I guess, for picking up languages at the highest level is before we're 10.
Right.
And yet, how many schools offer foreign languages?
Very few. There are some, but very few.
To say nothing of the fact, most foreign languages in this country are taught visually. And you do not learn a foreign language through your eyes. You learn it through your ears. And I have a terrible problem in France because I can get along all by myself. I can read, and
yeah.
I can translate, and I carry my little dictionary all the time for a small vocabulary, but if one is immersed in the, I can't hear it. If I ask a question, it has to be answerable by we or no or pointing. Because they say a sentence, and I'm still trying to figure out the first two or three words, and they're at the end, and I say, répétez, s'il vous plaît, and part of the phrase court. By little phrases, and if you hear just a short phrase and then another short phrase, and pretty soon you have a whole sentence. But there again, in English, I speak to foreign speaking people in phrases in English, not too fast, but I don't separate every word.
Right.
I put things together so that they somehow hear phrases and
you're very considerate.
I've been there.
Not all people are that considerate to foreign speakers.
Yeah, well, I've been there and done
exactly.
that, and I know what it's like. So.
Exactly. I wanted to look at her second quotation here also. I think it's very tied in. She was talking about her education. And what she said, when she was in school, all of the books that she had, she talked about reading Oliver Twist and Tale of Two Cities, and she was reading all these things about British people. And she says here, it's very hard to go to school and all the literature you read has nothing to do with me. That had a tremendous impact on me. It's very difficult to read something in a language that has no clue what you are about. And you alluded to that also in our urban centers, when the literature you're reading just has nothing to do with you. A lot of schools in the United States are trying to make a more multicultural curriculum for reading so that it can include a little more of everybody. But this woman had nothing. There were no African people in her reading. There was nobody that could relate to her life and her way of seeing the world as she.
to just think back for a minute. Think back to when you learned how to read. What kind of books were you reading?
Dick and Jane,
okay. What other
books? Dr. Seuss.
Curious George.
Yeah, my mother taught me to read the novels first.
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
She didn't like picture books.
Yeah?
She loved novels first. Where the wild things are.
Ooh, yeah. Now, what you have here are pictures that we, as Americans, understand, and stories that we can understand, and the stories are in our language. They're all in our language. Now I want you to just imagine that English is not a written language. It's only an oral language. And bye, Mom. And you go to school, and all the books you read are A, in another language, and B, all of the images that you see are about another culture. The people in the book look nothing like you. Yeah, maybe the Sudan. But they know nothing about you.
Are those two different issues? I mean, yes, one can be a language difference, but that's the choice of literature that the teachers are making.
Yes.
And I found it hard to believe that there's nothing that doesn't look, nothing that looks like her in English or close to her, because there's such a wealth of literature out there.
There is.
A good teacher who's sensitive to this type of, and I understand what she's talking about, but a good teacher who's sensitive to this can easily substitute other materials. I mean, granted, I wouldn't want to read Oliver Twist or Tale of Two Cities either. It's really not that interesting. It's 200 years old, and it's just, it's not going to hold your interest even if you're an American or an English person. So I think those are two different issues.
I think they're two different issues, but very related.
Yeah.
In her school, she did not have sensitive teachers. Mm-hmm. She had teachers that had an agenda. They wanted to teach her how to be a good English citizen. They wanted to teach her how to think like them. I think it's important for teachers to think about exactly what you said. Mm-hmm. Because when we learned how to read, we learned about other cultures also, at least I did. I was reading about kids from all over the world, and I loved reading that stuff. But I was also reading a lot of stuff that was very familiar to me. And so I think what you said is a good part of the solution. Mm-hmm. You're a good optimistic person.
I look at the glass half full. I mean, I can...
Yes.
I don't understand why these things... when we debate, you know, like in California, should there be bilingual education, et cetera, I think, why can't these things coexist? I mean, I see so much value in raising bilingual children, in learning other language, that the idea that one should displace the other is so foreign to me that I just don't even understand the debate or why we're talking about it, because I see so much advantage. I mean, I envy people who can speak multiple languages. I struggle to learn the one I do know beyond English. And so the fact that all the other people have this chance to learn other things and don't appreciate it really, really irks me. So that's my viewpoint. So I think I have a different viewpoint than most Americans though.
Were you saying that there is no written language in this young woman's country?
Her, at least not in her native language. I don't know about the other languages in the country.
Yeah, because maybe this is her calling, to write in English things that would be of value to her countrymen.
Here's one thing she says. I hope one day we maybe start writing my language and try to make sure that students create a social awareness whereby, from elementary school, instead of the kids learning English, they will learn my language and develop orally and written in my language. She says then, because linguistically any oral language is not a civilized language, because civilization is considered to be written. So what she does, in fact, feel that's part of her calling. She wants to help preserve her language in the Sudan. I've heard the term linguistic ecology used, where the English is going to spread. There's no way English is not going to continue to be learned around the world. There's no way any of us would really want to stop that problem. But I think it can be done thoughtfully. And I think that's well worth thinking about. How can we teach English to people and at the same time preserve their cultural identity and preserve their own languages. I agree with you. I can't understand why it's a problem for kids to be seen as a problem for kids to be raised bilingually. Mm-hmm. And I think,
yeah, because I mean, I know a number of friends who either were raised bilingual or are raising their children bilingual, and in very different cultures than American. I know friends who are Chinese, Mexican, Vietnamese, and who have been raised that way. And I know it hasn't been easy for them too, because they have their own struggles, but like I said before, I'm so envious, because it's not just the language, but they are fluent in the culture, which is something you can never learn from. You can never be 100% comfortable with if you're learning it from the outside. It's something exactly. You really need to grow up in. So I see that as being really valuable. Those people have really valuable skills that will become more and more important in the future as things become more interconnected, more global. They will have incredible advantages that the rest of us who only speak one language or one and a half don't have. They're the ones who are going to be the elites in the future.
Rich.
Is Vietnam an example of this? As I understand it, I believe they did not have a written language, and the French came in and developed a written system for Vietnamese. And maybe people that know more about it than I do could comment on that, and whether it's been helpful for them and helped them maintain their culture or what.
Anyone know a lot about this particular issue?
I have seen written Vietnamese, but I have no idea when that was developed, if that's not a more recent invention or not.
I remember when I first saw written Vietnamese, I was expecting characters that I couldn't recognize. And when one of my students wrote something out for me, I asked them, I felt really stupid afterwards. I'm like, well, how do you write that in Vietnamese? I thought they were just doing a spelling that I could recognize. And they just kind of looked at me and they said, yeah, Vietnamese. And I thought, oh, okay. So, that is an excellent example of how, probably because of that, more things can be written and the language can be preserved in that way. And does anyone else know?
No, I was going to comment.
This is, okay.
The term linguistic ecology is something that I'm not familiar with, but I can relate to it, because a lot of the questions of ecology in having to do with nature, we come to realize very quickly, have economic trade-offs.
Right.
And you have to make a value judgment as to what you need to save. And the same thing is going to be true for languages. And some people have had to begin to deal with this, and others have not. And again, our experience is we lived in Wales. And right about the time we were leaving there, the Welsh language movement was really booming. They would go out and tear down all the street and road signs that were in English and hand write Welsh ones. And so they decided that they would try to maintain a bilingual and have signs in both. And all city council meetings and things like that the minutes had to be transcribed and published in both. Wow. Well, that is a terrible expense for a poor country.
Yeah.
So you have to decide, and we will have to decide, we probably won't, but those whose cultures are endangered have to decide how much they value that.
Exactly.
And it's very costly.
Jennifer, you brought up the question of the bilingual education issue in California, and that's really an issue around the country also. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth thinking of her comments, and it's certainly a very different situation, but thinking of her comments in light of the situation in the United States. What does it mean to be an immigrant to the United States and not learn the core curriculum in your native language? What does that mean?
Betsy?
Yes.
I read an article in the Seattle Times this week that was really interesting. It talked to the family that had immigrated here and are citizens now of the United States from Mexico, but that they don't want to be totally assimilated into the culture. And some of the things that the woman being interviewed talked about was feeling like this culture has such dominant values of no longer respecting the family as a really important unit, of really promoting individualism, of really promoting consumerism, and a lot of values that she doesn't want her family to have. And so she's she doesn't speak English, or at least very, very little, and doesn't really want to because she wants to preserve as much of her culture as she can and pass it on through her kids. And the way she sees it, the more that she and her family assimilate, the more her culture will be lost. I mean, I think ideally we will, of course, being able to speak English and Spanish is ideal, but you can't preserve two cultures at the same time.
There's Why is she here?
I think it's probably financial and probably other reasons. I think financial is
I'm not saying this to be nasty.
Yeah, no.
But I would question if somebody is that passionate about their own culture, why they're in a country, and I can understand what she has against our culture. I mean, I follow you exactly. I have the same quarrel.
Yeah.
But at the same time, to communicate, and in order to preserve your own culture here, you really have to learn English.
Yeah. Well, and obviously her kids will have to, and that's, but I think that's one of the tricky things that happens with languages, and I think it's something that we who have grown up in this culture, I mean, I know I look at, there are a lot of these values that I'm frightened that we have so strongly, I mean, consumerism and some of those things, and I wonder, are there ways that we can learn from other cultures? And so it's frightening to me to see that our culture kind of just rampages over all of these things.
And Lou, I think your question is very important, but another consideration is the issue of choice. Did she really choose to come here?
Yeah,
was
that's
she pushed
why.
Here by forces really beyond her control.
And but I know I would never move to France and expect everybody to speak to me in English.
No, of course
not. I would expect to learn.
And I don't think she expects that either, but I think that she's trying as much as she can to hold on to some values that are.
Sure.
But that brings up Chris.
I'm trying to be nasty.
Chris had a comment and then.
When I was growing up, I never read history books in school that talked about this country as being a Hispanic country. And then I went in college and since then to study Spanish in Mexico and then in Ecuador, and all my Spanish textbooks considered the United States a Hispanic country, and their story of the United States as a Hispanic country didn't start in New England with Pilgrim Rock. It's the Plymouth Rock. It started in the Southwest, and not any different in terms of the time structure, but just a different story starting at the different end of the country. And it really shifted my perspective and made me think about what's the version of American history that I tell. And so now it strikes me as odd to think of the United States as anything other than a Hispanic country. That's not all it is, but it certainly is and has been since the beginning. And I think that that's, for me, a powerful shifting of vision in the way I think about the country, and it makes it harder for me to accept English-only arguments in state legislatures and so forth.
Okay. And English-only is a whole another issue that's related to this. There's movements in the United States to make English the official language, which to me is kind of strange because English is the official language.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's the language used in government and schools. And
but it's not confined.
Right, but it's not confined to that. I think if we said English only, it would take away a lot of the possibilities that are very helpful, and it probably would even hurt the chances of other languages to be taught in our schools as a regular part of the curriculum.
Comment on what he said. We live in Arizona, and that is the Southwest, and I would say where I live, I'm feeling very at a disadvantage by not knowing Spanish.
Yeah.
There, as a counselor, for me to get jobs like in some parts of the city, I can't because I don't speak Spanish. So, you know, I think that perhaps we are overestimating how our English is going to have in the future, because I think that many of us are going to need to learn to speak Spanish in the future, particularly because they say by the year 2012 or something, we white English speaking people are going to be a minority in the United States of America. So, you know, I mean, I don't dispute that English is the language of the world and the power and all of that, but I do think that we will feel some pressure ultimately to learn Spanish, and I'm going to try, I haven't yet.
And I think that would be really good for us. I think that would be a very healthy dynamic for us.
There's a lot of fear. What you said is so true, and there's a lot of fear from us and from us English speakers who are afraid to, who don't know their Spanish and want English to continue to be the language of power.
We're
very comfortable, and we are really fearful of people of, I think it shows with the bilingual education, which has happened in California, what happened with Proposition 187, that we're really fearful of losing that and, losing that power of our language. And what were you talking about? What was the comment you made about learning the bilingual education or learning that language at a young age? What just passed in California is basically going to wipe out some of these two-way bilingual education programs where English-speaking kids were learning Spanish along with the Spanish-speaking kids who were learning English. All those programs are wiped out. Because of our fear. Because of our fear that, these people who speak Spanish are going to take over. God forbid, and we're not going to understand what's going on in our own neighborhood.
Right.
Because all our signs are going to be in Spanish, it's just this irrational fear.
And it is, exactly, you're right.
Why else are these propositions passing, other than fear?
I think a lot of people are fearful. You're not, because you're thinking about it very reasonably, but a lot of people aren't thinking. That's one reason I want to have this discussion, just to hear all the different perspectives that people have on this.
In the education system, I think it, besides fear, I think that is a major factor in the education system and why it doesn't change, and why we still are having in American schools the same education system that we had in the 1940s, even though they know it wasn't as successful as other things are, they won't change it, and they know that they should start language earlier, and they know that individual teachers should have more power to teach what they want to teach, and that one curriculum doesn't work for every school and across the country, and it's a huge problem that teachers don't have enough power, because there is this very strict curriculum that has to be followed, and it
also has to do with money. Schools are strapped, and
that is a huge problem.
That's one of the things that goes first.
Right.
We don't need to educate people, we need more weapons.
It's been an interesting contrast. I've lived in British Columbia for the last almost 7 years, and it's interesting, their attempt to try to be a bilingual country. Every grocery item you get, there's French and there's English on it. But what's been interesting is the contrast. They're the first country that's passed a multiculturalism specific policy that was passed in the 70s, where the contrast has been to be in this country and then be in Canada, where for years, and I still think in a lot of places in this country, it's still in place, well, there's that melting pot mentality. It's like you forget your culture, you become an American, whatever that is, and you speak English and you let go of all of that which you wore, I guess, in order to become what you're supposed to be, I guess. Where it's been interesting in Canada with the multiculturalism policy, where it's been very much reinforced and encouraged for you not only to be Canadian, whatever that is, but also to, at the same time, to uphold and to continue to live and to hold on to your, quote, mother culture, or the culture that you, came from. And it's been really interesting that it doesn't have to be an either or. You can have both, and you can have a very rich experience with it.
And I think that's what kind of policy is it? A government?
It was passed in the Trudeau administration.
That's wonderful.
It was in the early 70s, and it's a multiculturalism policy.
Well, we keep talking about why don't Americans learn a second language. Until rather recently, we have had no need. You go over to Europe, and right across the border is another language that's spoken. And you can learn Spanish or French or Dutch or Danish or Swedish or whatever by not going very far. Here we have to travel thousands and thousands of miles to meet up with people with whom we could communicate in a foreign language on a kind of general basis. Now, you may have a family move in next door that knows, and that would be, you know, great if you could learn to speak their language, but we don't have access to other tongues, so why bother learning them? There's no way of
practicing. In cities, we have more and more access.
Urban, in agricultural areas with Spanish.
Right, yeah.
You know, so this is more recent, however. When I was a youngster, anybody who spoke a foreign tongue, I was in awe of, because they had this wonderful capacity.
When I lived in Europe, I lived in the two smallest countries in Western Europe, and also the countries with the most languages. I lived in Switzerland with 3 official languages, and Brussels, Belgium. That's a city. Belgium with 3 official languages also, and it was so interesting to me to see, again, all the signs, and I thought it was fascinating. I really enjoyed that experience.
Yes. I was wanting to make one historical correction, Lou, that until very recently we didn't have a need to learn other languages. Actually, we did. It was because we were immigrants, or our ancestors were immigrants, and they needed to learn English.
Oh, right.
So, Judy's father, until he was 5 years old, spoke Norwegian. And a friend of mine whose grandfather went to seminary in Minnesota had to come out of seminary being able to speak 4 languages so that he could preach at the German church, at the Norwegian church, at the Swedish church, and at the English-speaking church. And the congregation that I serve right now was founded in 1880 by Danish immigrants who spoke Danish. And they continued to have Danish services for 60 years after the founding of the congregation.
Wow.
Same way with my home congregation, which was German, and then they didn't change to all English services until World War II. Hmm. So there was a little bit of coercion there at that time for that community, for the Germans, to learn English. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's important for us to remember that our country, for the majority of its time, has been a multilingual country.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly what Chris was bringing up with looking at the history in the southern United States, southwestern United States, as being Spanish and native languages before English got there.
I think it's really important for us to remember that we are a country of immigrants and to respect other cultures and languages as such.
Of course, the urban areas are where you have a greater concentration of them.
Definitely. Let's see. I'm going to read you another. One thing I wanted to think about is going back to this idea of colonialism that Chris mentioned at the beginning. There have been a number of articles and books written recently on the theme of linguistic imperialism, which I think is a really very powerful term. And so as you observe the world and English and the influence of English in the world, think about this term, linguistic imperialism. Is English being imposed on the place in ways that leave the people there no choice as to how much they learn, as to if they learn the language? Or is it being introduced to a place in a very thoughtful way that will help them to preserve their own cultures and their own way of life? Yes.
And another Welsh story. Our friends in Wales told us that our friend, when her mother went to school, who would be maybe 85, between 85 and 90 now, Welsh was the family language, the first language. When she went to school, there was a rule that the children had to speak English, and Welsh was not accepted in the schools at all. And if a child was caught speaking Welsh during the school day, he was given what they call, he or she, the Welsh knot. It was a rope tied in a knot that they had to wear around their neck. And their job was to catch somebody else speaking Welsh so they could pass the knot on to them, because the person at the end of the day who had the knot got hipped. For speaking Welsh,
so they had motivation for. Yeah, so there's one example.
Talk about imperialism.
If the
spread of English is considered imperialism. It's a very different kind of imperialism than, say, when the British ruled India. The spread of English right now follows a very functional pattern. I mean, I think it follows the spread of computers that were invented here. I think if Bill Gates had been Chinese, I think the language computers would be very different, I'm guessing. But a lot of these things were invented here first in English-speaking culture, and then were disseminated. So the English follows the products and the functions. So it's not really the language leading first and then bringing in the literature or anything. It's quite different now. And I think that's a really interesting phenomenon, especially with computers, for example, like you mentioned in German, that they use the English word. They do that in France. I remember speaking to someone in Spain who had studied computer science, and he said he had to do it in English because the computers used English for those, in the nuts and bolts, and the manuals were in English, and so he had to learn that in order to even learn how to work on the computer.
And that's a very good point, because why did English become so prominent suddenly when French was the language, international language, for so many, many years? Because so many things were invented here, and it antedates computers. Science and industry, all that kind of thing, emerged in this country and got spread abroad. Well, because we didn't know the foreign languages, it got spread in English, so they, in order to understand what we had to offer, had to learn English.
Another influence, I think, is the widespread popularity of American pop culture.
Very powerful. One of my professors talked about being in Slovenia and being in a bar where people were trying to speak in English to each other because it was kind of a cool thing to do, and they had their t-shirts in English and they had English music on the radio, and he was just sort of kind of blown away by this. It was very dorky.
Sometimes historical developments have consequences that cannot be foreseen and that kind of undercut the thing that got them started. And this happens often in history, I think. And so I completely agree, it's sort of world finance, which also drives popular culture, that has spread this. But there are, when the Association of Third World Theologians meet, the ones from China talk to the ones from Thailand in English. The ones from, one part of Africa talk to the ones from Latin America in English. And this could have, in other words, it's not just a matter of English speakers communicating with those whom they have colonized, but it's also becoming a vehicle by which people from various countries can speak to one another, and they might say things that the dominant English speakers would wish they weren't saying to each other, but which ultimately, it creates a whole new possibility of communication, which will not necessarily further always the interests of the people who first got it started.
Well, another example of that is Mahatma Gandhi. He's very anti-English things, doing these very revolutionary, radical things in English. Mm-hmm. He said all these things in English. If he had said them in his native language, which had a very small population of speakers, those people might have been influenced, but it would have never had the global influence that it did. Americans were watching Gandhi going, wow, that guy's incredible.
Well, that happened in Tiananmen Square in China as well. Mm-hmm. The students wrote their signs of protest in English because they knew that the American cameras would pick that up. And we can read English, but we can't read the Chinese characters. Right. So that was very smart on their part.
I think that's really important. Might call it the language of the oppressor to kind of look at older terms. It's not always the oppressor, but using the language of the oppressor to, like you said, undercut the very oppressor.
And not even necessarily deliberately, but just because the Latin American theologians can talk to the African.
Right, and that is exactly. I should tell Tate Ministry that the session is officially closed. because it's 9:30. But if you want to keep discussing, then it's a very interesting issue.